The Pacific Group is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meetings. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful to you to contact an anonymous organization that more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Good evening. My name is Ted M. and I am an alcoholic. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The format of this meeting is two 10-minute speakers followed by a main speaker. Our first 10-minute speaker is Mike C.
I'm Mike C. I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be here tonight. Thank you all for showing up for my sobriety. My sobriety date is 6/23/03, and my home group is Pacific Group. I have a sponsor. His name is Lloyd S. And, you know, I'm really, really, really grateful to be here for a lot of reasons. I'm glad that I'm sharing on Zoom for my first share at the Pacific Group. I've been coming around for about 7 years, and I'm glad it's not in the big room in front of 800 people. And I really thought that I wouldn't be nervous at all because I shared today in Chicago at a Zoom meeting for 10 minutes, and it was just smooth and fluent. I've shared at a lot of Zoom meetings over the last year, and it's really nice to be able to share in a Zoom meeting and not feel, a bunch of pressure with a bunch of people in front of you. So let me see. I want to thank Marty for asking me to share. This gave me an opportunity to do some serious reflecting. The Pacific Group, it's become very important to me. I didn't come running to the Pacific Group with open arms. My sobriety date, like I said, is 6/23/03. It's been about 17 years now. And I had a really, really rough path in sobriety. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York. I grew up with an Irish family. Father died of alcoholism. Grandfather died of alcoholism. Long line of Irish people that suffer from alcoholism. I'm the only member of my family that's sober, and my aunt is the only member in her generation who's sober. So it's a lot of people still drinking out there in my family, but I'm grateful to be where I'm at. And, I was doing some reflecting this morning on my way to work or getting ready for work at 5:30 in the morning. And I was thinking about my path to recovery. And my path to recovery was, like most alcoholics, not all alcoholics, I got out of jail, I got arrested. And then, my best thinking was the next day is I got to stop drinking. I got to stop doing what I'm doing. So I called central office, and they directed me to a place called the Marina Center over in Culver City. And that was about 20 plus years ago, probably 25 years ago. And I walked in the room, and it was a noon meeting. I had no idea what to expect, and I felt at home immediately. But, and I felt like I felt really good. But my story is this, is that for my first 8 or 9 years, I relapsed, and I couldn't stay sober. I would get 6 months. I would get a year. I would get a year and a half. I would get 3 months, 6 months, 9 months. I figured I wasn't doing the steps right. I didn't do a proper fourth and fifth. I didn't do a right 8 and 9, change sponsors, in and out, in and out, in and out. And, I'm really grateful to where I am today. I know I don't have a lot of time, but, for the newcomer or anybody who's in the room who's not doing well, who's not feeling good in their sobriety, I understand that. I've been through that struggle. Man, I was in the Marina Center, and, some of the people in Pacific Group that when I finally made it to PG, I recognized some of the people from the Pacific Group. I sat at my Friday morning men's stag, which is the meeting that I actually got some traction at. And the meeting was a solid meeting. It had guys like Jack M and Fran L. And I mean, old timers with a lot of sobriety that were carrying the message. And they put together a retreat, a men's retreat up in Beaumont. And that was about 18 years ago that I went to my first retreat. I went begrudgingly. But what happened at that retreat is I had a spiritual experience. And I didn't want to go to that retreat. And by the time the retreat came to an end on Sunday, I didn't want to leave. And I couldn't wait till next year. And that began my my desire to stay sober, like a new desire. And, you know, I'm going to be all over the place. I'm going to bounce around. I'm going to fast forward. I spent a lot of years in the Marina Center, like I said, coming in and out. Then I finally got some traction. And, you know, I used to go to the rush hour meeting on Friday. You know, I know Debbie O, really, we were really tight. She saw me come in my sobriety. She saw me struggle. She saw me stay. And, you know, good, 5 minutes. Excellent. Karen Garrison used to come to the Marina Center. And she used to hear me share all the time. She used to say, you know, Mike, you really got to come to the Pacific Group. You're going to love the Pacific Group. They're going to love you. You got to come there, Mike. And I'd say, okay, yeah, Karen, I'm coming. I'm going to make it over there. And she said this for years and years and years. And I never made it over there. But we finally moved over to, I moved over from Culver City and I moved over to West LA. And I'm just down the street from Ohio Street. And, you know, I said, you know what? I'm going to try to check out this meeting at Ohio Street. And actually, I had a friend, Bruce. He said to me, he said, listen, my girlfriend is speaking at Sunday night at Ohio Street. And I'd never been to Ohio Street. So I said to him, all right, I'll go over there and support her. I went over there and I sat down next to this gal. And she said, I'm new in sobriety. And I said, well, that's great. You know, I said, you should go here. You should go there. You should get a sponsor. You should do your steps. You should hook up with a bunch of women and, you know, and see how that goes for you. Well, we became friends and she stayed sober. She got a sponsor. She did all her steps. We became closer friends. We got married. We have a beautiful child who's sitting next to me playing on the floor right now, who's going to be 7 in July. No. You'll get, not right now, buddy. He wants to say hi to everybody. I can never get him on the camera. Now he wants to say hi. But a lot of you guys know my son, Owen, and my wife, Miriam. My wife has 11 years of sobriety, you know, and, you know, I finally made it. I finally made it to Ohio Street on Tuesday night. I went to a couple of the Friday night stags. I went to a couple of the big PG meetings at Ohio Street and I got overwhelmed. And I'm like, wow, these people are hardcore. They're too strict. I don't like it. You know, self-will, doing it my way kind of thing, you know. And then I went to a Tuesday night meeting and it was magic. It was like my Friday morning stag. It was like the Marina Center. I went to Tuesday night at Ohio and it was about 15, 20 people there, maybe 15. And I guess everybody else in PG was at a book study somewhere on Tuesday night. So it was me and Lloyd and Damon and Ned and all of these great people and a bunch of veterans from the VA, a bunch of newcomers all the time from the VA. And I really, really liked it. We were a really, really close knit group of people in sobriety. And that's where I really started to love sobriety with PG, because I was getting a taste of some of the PG members without the big crowd. And then, you know, one day I asked Lloyd to sponsor me. You know, actually he said to me, he said, don't you have something you want to ask me? And I said, yeah, as a matter of fact, I do. And I asked him to sponsor me. And that's been a great relationship. You know, Karen Garrison asked me to come to PG. And finally, when I made it to the big room, I would come in every week and I would see Karen Garrison sitting in her seat. And I would go over to her and I'd say, Karen, look, I made it. And I'd give her a hug and a kiss. And I was able to do that for, you know, a couple of years. But, you know, and I got to see some other people. You know, it turned out that while I was in the Marina Center, Joe S., you know, he was coming to our Friday morning stag for years. And he was like, hey, Mike, it's great to see you. So, and then, you know, I have all of these, you know, I got to tell you what I miss. I'm all over the place. Forgive me. What I miss about Wednesday night is I wasn't like in a great big hurry to go to PG. I didn't understand it. I kind of came in the side door Tuesday night, got a sponsor, started coming to the big meeting, got a commitment. And, you know, here I am Good. I got a minute left. Perfect. That went fast. I'm sitting behind my sponsor, Lloyd. I have Lloyd in front of me. I have Lydia. Behind me, I have Joe S. I have Glenn. To my right, I'm sitting next to Teresa. I look over the right. There's Hilda. There's Steve. I look over. There's the old man across the way. And I'm like, wow, this is really, really cool. You know, there's a lot of people in PG. You can't know everybody. But, you know, I want to share a funny story. Everybody in PG, there's so many people in PG have helped me so much. And I just want to say how grateful I am. You know, Janice and I became very close with Janice and Ned. And me and my wife were having a really, really tough time. So Janice says, tell your wife to call me. So my wife calls Janice and she's like, yeah, we're having this tough time, this and that, this and that. And Janice goes, honey, you just need to shut your mouth. And my wife calls me back. She's like, oh my God, that Janice. Oh, she told me to shut up. And I was like, all right. You know, I was like, I'm glad she said it. You know, I was thinking about that, but I love all of you guys and I love PG. And I'm grateful that the path I'm on in sobriety, I can now say that I'm on with a great group of drunks, Pacific Group, my home group. And I thank each of you for helping me in the last 7 years since I've kind of been with the group. And I look forward to the future. I look forward to getting back to some meetings and maybe talking to some of you guys that I haven't really met and become intimate with. So thank you so much for letting me share. I love and appreciate all of you. Have a wonderful evening.
Thank you. Our second 10-minute speaker is Julie W.
My name is Julie, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you so much, Mike. It's so good to see you. And thank you, Marty, for asking me to share in my home group tonight. It is an honor and a privilege to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything good in my life is a direct result of the actions that I've learned to take inside of this program. And I'm so grateful. Welcome to any newcomers. My sobriety date is September 29th, 2008. My sponsor is Lydia W. And my home group is Pacific Group. I grew up on the west side of LA. I am the only alcoholic in my home. And I think that's one of the reasons why it took me a really, really long time to figure out what was wrong with me, that I was an alcoholic. But I do remember that I was so uncomfortable in my own skin. I was anxious and nervous. I did not like myself. I was like a kid that got sick all the time and I wanted to miss school. I was just so full of fear all the time. And I needed a drink long before I took one. And I took my first drink at age 15. And my life changed on that day because I found something that helped me. I found my solution to my problem. When I took that drink, it made me feel okay. And that's all I ever wanted was to feel okay in my skin. I looked in the mirror. I liked the girl that I saw in the mirror. I thought I looked pretty. And I thought I was doing the things that other people, my friend, you know, my peers were doing at school. Like I thought that this is what they were doing and it made me feel cool. And that is all I ever wanted. And my life changed dramatically on that day. I went from like a girl who was like doing gymnastics and riding horses to party girl. Like I crossed the line on that day. And I started to pick up a lot of tabs really, really quick. I had a lot of consequences. I started crashing cars. Yes, cars, not just a car. And I dropped out of high school. I went on tour with the Grateful Dead. I was just, you know, I was off and running and I was willing, you know, I was willing to do anything that made me feel different. I got married when I was in my 20s. I thought that was going to fix me. It didn't. We had a beautiful baby girl and you know, by the time I was 32 years old, I landed into my first rehab. And one inpatient, two outpatients, and two sober livings later, I found myself 40 years old. I was a widow and I was a single mom. And my dad had custody of my daughter. And I'd been fired from a job, and my life was, I torn my life down. And I remember the day that my dad came to me and he said, "Julie, I think you need some help." And it was the last time that he came to me, and I had that moment that we have where I knew that I couldn't go on living the way that I was living anymore, and I needed to change. And I said yes to him. I had no idea that I was an alcoholic, even though I had been through all those treatment centers. I had no idea that this program was going to work for me, but I became willing on that day to do something different in my life. And it was on my 6 days sober. It was actually my dad's birthday. And I walked through the doors of Sunday Night, Ohio. And I walked through the back door actually of Sunday Night, Ohio. And I remember that day so clearly. Like I was in this brown hoodie sweatshirt and I was crying. And I just felt like so lost and so hopeless. And what happened was a complete miracle. Standing at the door were two people that I knew from outside the rooms. It was Ann P. and it was Tobin J. And I knew both of them. Ann was a mother on my daughter's gymnastics team. And she had been carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to me without even telling me that she was an alcoholic, but she was being very kind to me. And she was a good example of this program. And Tobin was my dad's personal trainer. And there they were, secretary and assistant secretary of that meeting. And if that's not God's grace, I don't know what is, because what happened that night is they pulled me into the center of that room and they introduced me to the women, which surrounded me, gave me their numbers and started telling me what I needed to do. and what would have happened is I would have sat in the back, talked to no one and left that meeting. And who knows what who knows if I'd be sitting here today. I got my sponsor right away. That's what I was told to do. And she started, walking me through. She told me to call her. She told me some really basic things. Like, call me every day. You're going to go to these meetings. You're going to get commitments at these meetings. And we're going to start reading in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to go through these steps. And I just started doing those things. And I was really, really willing because I was so broken inside that I just wanted to change. And slowly I started changing from the inside out. And this program was spoon fed to me. Things have come really, really slow for me. I went through those steps. And when I went to go make the amends to my dad, the first amends that I made to him, because I made several, but when I made that first amends, all he said to me was, "I just want you to stay sober and be a good mom to your daughter." That's all he wanted from me. And slowly, as I showed up and I did what I said I was going to do, and I stuck to my commitments, like I learned to do in the rooms, and I started doing that outside the rooms, and I started building this sweet relationship with my dad. And I was 5 years sober when I got custody of my daughter back. And that was really, really hard to wait that long. But I do know today that it happened exactly in the timing that it was supposed to. My life is, this journey has been amazing. There's been some amazing, beautiful times, and there's been some really, really hard times, and there's just been okay times, but it doesn't matter what's going on, because I'm grounded in this program with God, and I have tools to walk through anything today. When my dad passed last year, our relationship was so clean and it was so sweet. I was with him when he took his last breath, and there was so much love there. All the things that bothered me about him, it all melted away, because all I saw is this sweet father who tried to be a good dad to me for so many years. And my daughter, Alcoholics Anonymous gave my daughter a mother, and she's in college now. She's graduating on Saturday, and she's really doing well in her life. And I'm so grateful to be able to be present for her. If I weren't sober, I would have missed all of this. And I know today that my life is a gift. And, the obsession to drink was removed very quickly for me. But today, you know, fear is still present in my life. Fear is still something that happens in my life today. And so I have learned to use the tools that we got here in, you know, going through the steps and learning to bring God into everything I do and to show up no matter how I feel. And all the things that I'm in fear, when I walk through them, I always grow and I always get better after I walk through those things. You know, I'd just like to say, you know, if anyone is new in the rooms tonight, welcome. Grab a hold of your seat. It'll probably be the best decision that you ever make. Alcoholics Anonymous is by far the best thing that's ever happened to me. And I met Marty in walking out of the Wednesday night meeting. And we are about to celebrate 10 years together next week. And, you know, our relationship is grounded in this program. Like, we bring in God, and AA's is in our home. And I'm just really grateful for that. And I just want to thank you so much and thank you for my life.
Our main speaker tonight is Georgia B.
Hi, everyone. My name is Georgia and I am an alcoholic. And I am very grateful to be here and to be sober. And thank you, Marty, for asking me to do this. And thank you for being such a great secretary this year. I have loved working with this crew. It has been so much fun. When Marty was elected secretary, he called me and I saw his phone call coming up, and I thought he was going to ask me to do something like be head of cleanup or something really hard. And when he asked me to be the assistant secretary, I felt like I won Miss America or something. It was like, me? I just want to thank everyone who's made this possible. I was so happy. I love the Pacific Group. My whole life, I have been looking for somebody to love me so I'd be okay. I was always looking for a family. And these last 28 years, your joys, your pains, I've shared them with you. You know, the seemingly good and the seemingly bad, as Keith Carpenter used to say, we've all been through this together and you guys are my family. And I have found just what I was always looking for here. And I am so, so grateful. I was such a mess when I came here. My sobriety date is February 1st, 1993. I got sober when I was 24 and I was sure my life was over. And I can divide my life into these two halves. The first half, when I was drinking and making every decision based on how I felt, I thought that was integrity. It was really a mess. And then the last half of my life, making decisions based on what the next right action is with the help of a sponsor and all the tools I've been given here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what a difference this last half has been. And a big part of the joy I experience in sobriety today is as the result of doing things I don't want to do every single day. I am somebody who doesn't want to do anything ever. Even if something fun, when it's time to do it, I think, oh, I wish I didn't have to do that today. I don't want to do that. But because I've learned to say yes when my calendar is open, I just keep showing up to what's in my calendar for the day. And I've just been on the ultimate adventure. And I'm so grateful. I don't remember when I had my first drink, but I was arrested for drinking in public when I was 11, which, you know, when I see my friends who have kids, I think, how could that be? You know, I was just a baby, but I didn't feel like a baby. My dad had died of cancer when I was 6, and I was raised by a single mom who worked 3 jobs. And so she wasn't home very often. And I fended for myself. I've never been grounded. I've never had any rules. And I had that God-sized hole in my gut. And I was always looking for somebody to love me so I'd be okay. And I was always looking to get rid of that pain that I felt. I feel like I was born singing the blues. You know, all of my emotions were so big. And so I started hanging out with the older kids in the neighborhood, and they were smoking and they were drinking. And so I started smoking and I started drinking, and I'm a thrill seeker. So I started stealing my mom's car and cruising that around the neighborhood. And like I said, I never had any rules. So it was really easy for me to do these things. These things don't make me an alcoholic. The effect that alcohol had on me was is what makes me an alcoholic. I did not drink like my fellows. Well, certainly at that age, I didn't, because I didn't know any other 11-year-olds who were drinking. But as I grew older, I didn't drink like my fellows either. But I didn't understand alcoholism. I was raised, my former sponsor, Tracy J, used to say, "Honey, if it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, honey, it's a duck." And I think I was raised in a family of ducks. And so there was nothing, it didn't seem unusual to me. My behavior was not shocking, surprisingly, to my mom or to my grandma, and they were my only family. So when I drank, from the beginning, I drank like a pig. There was never really any social drinking. It was really just to get rid of that pain that I felt, that bone chilling loneliness that I've only heard other alcoholics identify with. But at that time, I thought I was the only one. And, you know, I'm an old English 800 girl, 10 high whiskey. I've never put a cork back in a bottle. I don't understand what that means or why you would do that. You know, that's how I drink. I hated myself so desperately, which made it even that much more important that you love me. I heard Patrick S. say in this meeting that my first higher power was your approval, and I needed it like I needed oxygen. And so I was trying to fit in. I was trying to make people love me, which usually pushes them away. I had my first suicide attempt at 12 years old. I had another one at 13. And then I tried once again, right before I got sober in my 20s, because that was the only thing I could think of to do with all of these emotions and how difficult life was. I just wanted out. And alcohol gave me an out when I drank, but it was temporary because I'd sober up and then all that pain. And then sometimes I was the crying girl at the party. That's no fun. But most of the time I was the fun girl. I was the one like, "I don't know, what should we do?" And I'd say, "I don't know either, but once I have a few drinks, I will." And I was the girl you didn't want your kids hanging out with. So drank like a pig my whole growing up. By the time I'm 13, I'm pregnant. I terminated that pregnancy at the urging of my mom and my grandma. And then I drank and used over that. I felt such regret and remorse about that. And I learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous that we don't regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. But for me, things stay in a place of regret until I can either use that experience to help someone else out or to change something that I'm going through. But back then I was just collecting regrets, and this was just the beginning, you know. And my mom, as I said, was working very hard, 3 jobs. She never dated again. She never had any friends again. Her only entertainment was she would come home and sit in front of the TV. And when she knew that I was going to graduate from high school, which I did just barely, I just made it. She claimed bankruptcy and moved home to her mother, my grandmother. They were my only family. And I was 17 years old when she moved away, and I've been on my own since. I don't know how I survived until I got to you, how I paid bills. I honestly don't, but I had some success. Immediately out of high school, I got a really great job, but just like I always do, I build my life up and I tear it down because I cannot not drink. And it's always going to be the thing I choose. It's always going to be more important than anything else. And so, I ended up at the end of my drinking with that. I had that last suicide attempt. And then my roommate at the time had a brother who had a little problem with crack cocaine. I know now that there are no little problems with crack cocaine, but I didn't know that at the time. And she asked if he could come stay with us. And it turned out that he had a pretty serious problem. But my problem was that he was crazy about me and I needed him to love me so I'd be okay. And so when I had the opportunity, I started doing that with him. And within 6 months, I lost everything. I got evicted from where I live, fired from my job, and he sold my car to get some more one night. And when I had no place to go, it was my best friend's parents who took me in. And this experience, you know, at the time, of course, I didn't appreciate it. But when I look back, I see that had this not happened, I may not have gotten to you when I did. And, you know, I had been to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with friends who really needed it over the years, because I'm a good friend and I would just pop in to support them. And I would hear it. Well, first I thought, I'm not as bad as you guys. But now that I had this crack experience, I thought, now I'm too bad. I don't fit here. But I always found some reason it wouldn't work for me. And I wasn't raised with any kind of religion. I didn't believe in God. And if there was a God, I didn't care for his work so far. So I just knew that that wasn't an option. And so when I lost everything and I had no place to go, my best friend's parents took me in. And that's really that last year there is where I really got to see my alcoholism. I really got to understand that, because I really knew I had a problem with drugs. That was for sure. But I still didn't see the alcohol being a problem. But that was the heart of the problem. I believe my alcoholism is going to get me wherever I'm weak. It's always looking for a way out. And so I really got to see that. And I tried white knuckling it. And that was the most miserable I'd ever been. And I thought, if I'm going to be miserable, I'd rather be drunk and miserable. And so I poured my first guilt-free drink. You know, I had tried quitting. And then every time I picked up a drink, I'd feel so guilty and terrible. But this time I made the decision, if I'm going to be miserable, I'm going to be drunk and miserable. And I poured that drink proudly and freely, and the phone rang. And it was a man named Jeff Monahan. And I love talking at my home group because you guys knew him. It was Jeff Monahan. And he said he was working with my best friend, Diana, whose parents I was living with. She had moved to San Diego and worked at this company and met Jeff. And Jeff had told him that he was sober. And she started confiding in him about her loser friend, me. And so he offered to call me, and he said, I understand you have a problem with alcohol. And for whatever reason, I told the stranger on the phone, yes, I do. And he said, I want to give you the number of a woman to call in AA. And he gave me the number of Pat Y. And I called Pat. And she said, my husband and I are going to a meeting tonight. Why don't you come with us? Which, you know, the day before I would have had 1,000 reasons why, but I said, okay. And I drove to this stranger's house and got into this stranger's car. Now that's not unusual, but doing that sober was unusual. And Pat and Vince brought me to the big Wednesday night meeting, which was different than any meeting I'd ever been to. People seemed to be happy and sober at the same time. I thought it was an or conversation. You're happy or you're sober. You can't be both. But I felt hope for the first time. And, you know, I get goosebumps every time I share this part of my story, because a stranger called me, gave me the number of another stranger who took me to a room full of strangers. And I've been sober ever since. And if you're new, and I welcome you, and you may come into the meeting and think, well, all these people all know each other and they've been friends for years. How will I ever fit in? And you just do. You just keep coming back. You get, as I was taught by Pat in my early days, you go to regular meetings on regular days. You get a commitment at each of those meetings, you know? And so Pat said she'd be my sponsor until I found one, and started me on this really simple course of action, because I was 24 and a half. And I thought I needed to get on the fast track. I'd already wasted too much time. We need to get going. You know, I need to quit smoking, get a good diet plan, get a good exercise regime. Now that I'm well, it's time for a relationship, got to get a job, going to go to school. And basically I was told, you know, slow your roll, get a first year foundation. And this is one of the great things about being part of a home group, is everybody's talking about the same thing. You're hearing the same language. Get your first year foundation. That's what you're going to build the rest of your sobriety upon. All the time and energy you want to put into going into school, putting your steps done, get a little job to go to in between meetings, don't quit smoking, no major changes, and for God's sake, no relationship. And so I had made, you know, like little commitments in my head, like I'll try this for 30 days, I'll try this for 60 days. But then I kept hearing that first year foundation. And I made a decision that I was going to do everything that I was asked to do and really give this thing a try. And I would try this because I knew it wasn't going to work for me, but I may as well try it so I could move on and go back to my glamorous life of drinking. And, but I have not had to do that yet. And so I got involved. I started calling Pat every day and she told me, you know, go to regular meetings on regular days, get commitments. And I have never had structure in my life ever. I always thought structure was the man trying to keep you down. People over 30 who don't understand freedom, you know, structure is not cool. But what I found out or what I came to learn was I've never had structure in my life. I never went to school on a regular basis. I never went to work on a regular basis. I've never had structure. I never knew what it was. And when I began to get structure in my life, I began to settle down and I began to feel safer. And I began to feel more creative. And the more structure I had, the more I did, the more I could do. And it was like time could bend. And it was so contrary to what I had believed. And so I got involved. And I was about 2 weeks sober. And a family friend came forward and told me all these secrets that my mom and grandma had kept from me. And I had always suspected something with them over the years. There always seemed to be secrets. My mom and grandma behaved strangely to each other. They whispered, they talked even in a secret language, which Sharon helped me learn that is carny talk. It's a language that's like pig Latin, but with a bunch of Z's. It's like abadoba wamba tuba goba tuba scuba, which is actually Fat Albert, but it's like that kind of language, but with a bunch of Z's. Anyway, so this family friend came forward and said, I stuff. And I was like, oh, I knew it, which is my favorite thing to say. And he told me all these secrets, and I like to be super specific when I throw something in your face. So I wrote down everything. I'm like, uh-huh, what else? Uh-huh, uh-huh. And my plan was to take this to my mom and tell her what I really thought about her, because I believe that was integrity. Luckily, I went to Pat first, and she said, it's so good you have that written down. You're going to need that later. And I had no idea what she meant. But she suggested that I work on being a good daughter and granddaughter, which sounded crazy to me. But I'd made that decision that I was going to do everything I was asked to do. And I almost did it, you know, kind of like, well, I'll show you it's not going to work. But I don't know how to be a good daughter or granddaughter. So we came up with a formula, and that said I would call once a week, I'd write once a week, and I'd visit as often as I could. And if I were doing these things, I would know at the end of the day when my head hit the pillow that I'd been a good daughter and granddaughter. And maybe, just maybe, I could stay sober. Because where my mom and grandma were concerned, I felt fierce love and loyalty and hideous responsibility and guilt and blame and shame and embarrassment with a side order of hatred. And I don't think I could have stayed sober with that kind of angst had I not started changing my behavior right away. And so I started making the weekly calls, super awkward at first. I always kind of had a topic. And then I started sending a card once a week. And eventually I did, after doing this for a while, I was picking up the pace, and I started, my cards began to be more like letters. And I would write about my adventures in sobriety. And I started imagining how my mom and grandma must be savoring each of these cards and perhaps rereading them on a cold winter's night, or, you know, maybe keeping them tied with a lovely ribbon or in a beautiful decorative box. And that wasn't what was happening. I made my call to my mom many months into this process. And my mom said, well, we've been getting your cards, but grandma's been having to wipe them out to reuse them. And we're wondering if you could start writing them in pencil. And so I did. I wrote those danged cards in pencil. And I want to tell you why, because this is so important. I now had a sponsor who told me I would never have to go through anything alone, and that I could take all of my problems to her. I was having an experience of my own higher power as the result of going through the steps with a sponsor. I had more friends than I dreamed a girl of like me could ever have. And I learned that I had more tools than I ever knew existed. And it may not be fair, but he with the most tools has the most responsibility. And in this case, it was me. Crazy. So I started writing those damned cards in pencil. And I wrote a little bit less at first to punish them. but they didn't notice, which is fine. But I kept doing that. And I do want to say this, many years into this, like maybe 3 years into this, I accidentally slipped one through in pen, and I called and my mom said, "Well, we got your card," but it was in pen. And I wasn't feeling so spiritual that day, but I knew well enough to get off the phone. And so I was like, "Oh, look at the time. I've got to run." And I called Marilyn, who's been my sponsor for the last 26 years. And I said, "That's it. I write, I call, I visit, I'm done." And Marilyn said, "Oh, I think you've made a wonderful amends to your mother and grandmother, and you don't owe them anything else." And I said, "Yes." And she said, "However, I think it would be a wonderful spiritual exercise if you continued to do so." And so I did. And that's kind of how Marilyn gives me direction. I take options to her and she'll say, "Well, you could do option A, or you could fight for the good. It's up to you." Is it? But anyway, my relationship with my mom and grandma changed. And I do want to say this, that this was such a huge lesson in learning that I am only responsible for my side of the street. What you do on your side of the street is none of my business. And the dirtier your side of the street is, the cleaner mine needs to be. And this exercise in being a good daughter and granddaughter was not if I deemed them worthy, not if they reciprocated in a way that I did not find distasteful. If, you know, there were no ifs. It was just my actions define who I am. And I wanted to be a good daughter and granddaughter. And my mom and grandma also never thought that they should have to call me. A real phone call went like this: "Well, we wanted to wish you a happy birthday, but you didn't call." And my mother was mad at me. And I'm like, this is crazy. So what I learned was that on my birthday, instead of pacing by the phone like I would in the past and, you know, say, "I know they're not going to call. I know they're not going to call." And then at the end of the day, the magic, "I knew it." I could instead on my birthday, pick up the phone and say, "Today is my birthday. And I just want to tell you, I love you." Boom. And go on with my day. I remember hearing Sharon C. talk about changing the radio station when she heard a sad song. And I was like, "Phew!" Like that idea never occurred to me. I'm an emotional cutter. I go deep. I turn it up. I try and find another sad song to follow it. It never occurred to me how much power I had on my side of the street. And the only access to that power exists on my side of the street. It is not on yours. I will fiddle about over on your side of the street looking for power from time to time, but I've never found it there. Anyway, you know, I continued to build this relationship with my mom and grandma, and I went through the steps of a sponsor, and I ended up turning one, which I just never dreamed. And I got really active in the Pacific group. I was going to the yard. I was doing every show. I remember Tracy was my sponsor, and I confided in her that when I was 16 years old, my friend had a band and I love to sing. And so they had a band and they would play at all these parties. And I learned their one original song. I learned how to sing it. I sung it all the time. And every time they play it, I'd say, "Are you playing Veil tonight?" And this one night I go to the party, I'm like, "Are you playing Veil tonight?" And I'm saying Veil in case you're saying, "What is she saying?" And they said, "Only if you sing it." And I was like, "Oh, me, yes." And then I got super hammered and then did some outside issues. And so I was like totally crazy, horrible. And that night they recorded it. And the next day I got a copy of that cassette and I listened to it in my car by myself. And I couldn't believe that I destroyed something I loved so much. And it like, a part of me, I'm telling you, part of me died. It was so painful. And I shared that with Tracy and clearly she didn't hear me because she told me to go audition for the Mountain High show. And I'm like, what? And I was so nervous. I showed up an hour early to Brian A's house. And I remember him coming out. I'm sitting on the curb of his house. I'm just a couple months sober and I'm weeping. And he said, "You must be here for the Mountain High audition." I'm like, but he was very kind to me. And over the years, I've done like almost 40 of these shows that we do in the Pacific Group, and it's been such a joy. And, you know, I just got involved. I became a part of this group, and it's been such a joy. And I got into the workforce, and I had to have minor back surgery in when I was about 2 years sober. And then I had to have major back surgery when I was, 1999. So I was like 6 years sober. And this major back surgery was a spinal fusion. And it was supposed to be like a 6 month recovery time. But I was in that 1% where something went wrong. And I ended up being bedridden for like a year. And it was this group that took care of me, that brought meetings to me, that took me to the Wednesday night meeting. I would, I'd lay in a beach chair on one of the side, the wing of the stage where no one could see me, but I could see the speaker. Or I would be in a beach chair, a lounge chair in the back of the Saturday night meeting. It was such a humbling time because I couldn't take care of myself. I found that emptiness that I was constantly trying to fill with your approval, that the only way to fill that is by giving. Getting is good, but it has never filled that emptiness. It is when I'm lonely, I have to pick up the phone. I have to be of service. And I had learned to be of service. You know, Marilyn forced us, I'm not kidding, to watch a movie called The Magnificent Obsession. It's a Technicolor movie with Rock Hudson. And it is so fabulous. It's all about, here, a spoiler alert. It's all about how this this playboy, rich, hotshot guy learns the true secret of happiness and being of service. And that's kind of where I was at. It was like my life was operating at a high velocity. 24/7, I was moving, working, going to meetings, taking meetings to sick people's homes, taking classes. And then I had this back surgery and my life came to a screeching halt. And I had to have babysitters. I had people taking care of me every night. Very humbling, but I learned that that was a way I could be of service. And you know, when I look back at my life and I look at these most difficult times, they turn out to be some of the best times of my life. The times where I felt the most joy, where I felt the most connected, where there just wasn't any BS. It was just pure, you know, and people who were babysitting me, I honestly wouldn't have had a cup of coffee with, and they were taking care of me and I got to get to know people. And my mom and grandma couldn't be there for me during that time. I don't know why, you know, and another thing I've come to learn is sometimes we go through things and we think certain people should be there and they're not. And then we feel sad about that. And what I've learned is that that's not about me. It is not personal. And that God has always put just the people I need at just the right time. And that's been my experience. So I was going through this horrible period. I was filled with uselessness and self-pity. And I became friends with a man named Mike Finch. You know, I can pray for a character defect to be removed. In this case, it was this uselessness and self-pity that I was experiencing. And what normally happens is an assignment appears. And in this case, it was this man named Mike Finch. He'd been diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease. He was 34 years old. And I watched him go from walking and talking to being paralyzed from the neck down. But the thing that never changed about him was his joy and his love of Alcoholics Anonymous. He used to say there's no cure for ALS except for AA. And he was such an inspiration and he sponsored all of these guys and he laughed and laughed. I used to call him the Make-A-Wish boy, which I know is very distasteful, but he had a good sense of humor. He just lived differently, you know, and it was such an attraction to me. And he and I became friends and then we became more than friends. And I was able to spend the last 6 months of his life with him, which was such a great honor. You know, I've spent my whole life trying not to feel the bad feelings, the scary, the angry, the hurt. But what I've come to find out and what I've learned by your examples is that all of my feelings are gifts and I need not fear them anymore. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me this beautiful net with God, sponsorship, the steps, the fellowship. And so I get to take these big leaps and I get to love a man I know is going to die and it's not going to break me. And I get to pursue dreams and fall on my face. And because that beautiful net is there and it won't break me and I never have to do anything alone. So I was with Mike. I was able to be there holding his hand when he died, which was such a great privilege. And it doesn't always happen that way, but it happened that way for me. And I'm so grateful. About a month before Mike passed away, my grandma died. Now, my grandma was literally the meanest person I've ever met in my life. Every family picture and with she and I in it, she looks like this. She was so mean. She used to tell me what a terrible daughter I was, how I ruined my mom's life, if my dad were alive, how disappointed he'd be in me. And she was always like sloppy drunk. In fact, she was the town drunk of the town she lived in. And she did other things that are not important. You get the idea. She did not like me very much. And she let me know that. But so in sobriety, I'd started doing the cards and making the calls and slowly building a relationship with her without her ever going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, quitting drinking, or really doing anything much different. She became a sweet grandma, and I started calling her Granny Goose, and we had a beautiful relationship. And I think that's because just as our disease ripples out into the lives of the people we love, so does our recovery. And so I got to build this sweet relationship, sweet relationship with my grandma. And when she died, we were good. And I got to be there for my mom. And then Mike passed away. And then I ended up moving back to Los Angeles. I had moved to San Diego to be with Mike. And when I moved back to Los Angeles, there's my 5 minutes. I had a hard time getting back involved in the group. I wasn't willing to do all the stuff I was willing to do when I was new, and it was a little bit more difficult for me at my own fault. But my mom asked to see me, and so I drove up to where she was living. I had gotten a little job. I started to build up my life again, and she told me all those secrets that I'd written in that book. I had not found it necessary to throw them in her face all those years. And she sat down with me and she told me that at 8 years old, my grandma was sent to live with another family because her family couldn't take care of her and her sister. And she cooked and cleaned and was physically and sexually abused, never went to another day of school. And the way she got out of that is she married a man she didn't love, had my mom when she was 18. And by the time my mom was born, she'd already left that man. And then she started leaving my mom to live with other families and then in boarding schools, but she'd forget her over the summers. And so my mom never had really any parents, and she'd be with the nuns over the summers in shoes that didn't fit her. And she longed to be part of a family and longed to be loved. And when she was given the opportunity to go live with my grandma, she said yes. And by that point, my grandma had turned to a life of racketeering and prostitution. And so she turned my mom out to work that business. And so my mom never went to another day of school, and she was physically abused and sexually abused. And my mom told me this story. It took 2 days for her to tell me all of these things. Now, the secrets I had found out when I was new were very minor compared to what she was telling me. I heard that my mom and dad weren't married, which my mom said that was correct. She was my dad's mistress. That she had embezzled the money that my dad left me. Well, it turned out his survivor benefit went to his wife. That my dad was an alcoholic and a womanizer. And so these were the secrets that I had written in that little book, but she told me so much more. And I'm so glad I heard it when I had some AA under my belt. I always thought that my mom withheld these things from me because she deemed me unworthy. She withheld love and guidance because she thought I wasn't worthy. And I was mad at her for not giving me that, but she never had it. She never possessed it. So I'd been mad at her for not giving me something she never possessed. And so as she told me this story over the next couple of days, which is to this day, the worst story I've heard inside or outside of Alcoholics Anonymous, I just listened, and I got to say things like, I'm so sorry that happened to you. And then I got to see, she told me the story about how she had put up two babies for adoption in her teens. And then I began to see why she insisted that I terminate that pregnancy when I was 13. I thought she was punishing me and that she wanted to hurt me, but it was because she wanted to spare me the pain that she knew, her reality, her perception of the world. And I look in hindsight and I see how everything that she did was to ensure that I did not have the life that she had, or that my grandma had. I had the life of a princess compared to the life that she had. And thank God you taught me to act that way before I felt that way. And I began to have a mad crush on my mom. I thought she was the coolest thing ever because I heard all of your stories and I wasn't afraid of her story. And I just thought she was like a superhero. She kept me in the same house until I graduated from high school. And I just thought she was so cool. And when she got sick later on, oh, my time's almost up. I got to wrap up. I was able to take care of her the last few months of her life. And I just have to tell you this because it describes her so beautifully. She's 75 years old. She got bone cancer and then brain cancer. And we were going to the hospital for yet, thank you, Lydian, for yet another test. And the x-ray technician came out and my mother looked at him and said, "This won't affect my ability to bear children, will it?" And I laughed so hard. She was so funny and I didn't have to miss it, you know, just because she didn't give me what I thought I needed or whatever. I learned here about love and tolerance and about tending to my side of the street. And next to getting sober, the greatest thing that's happened to me is working at the Midnight Mission. I get to take all the love and hope I get in these rooms to Skid Row every day. I started as a volunteer following Clancy. You know, I followed Clancy to the Pacific Group. Well, he was here first, but I feel like I've been on Clancy's coattails my whole sobriety. This group gave me the life I have today. The Midnight Mission gave me the deeper meaning and purpose in my life. And, you know, I have an excellent relationship today. I'm terrible at relationships because I'm in them. And so I've done a lot of work over the years, step work and just learning who I am and how to be in a relationship. And I said a prayer that went something like this: "God, I'm done meddling. If you want me to be with someone, you're going to have to make it happen." And then I let go of that idea. And then this sweet fellow named Jason asked me out and I said yes. And we've been together ever since. And I think what makes it work is that we don't complete each other. We enhance each other's lives. I was always looking for someone to complete me, but what that means is without you, I'm incomplete. And then I make you responsible for my happiness. And wow, what a train wreck that was. But thank you for my life. I am so grateful. I love you guys so much. Thank you for listening.
AA birthdays at this meeting. We define as sobriety as freedom from alcohol, pills, pot, or anything which affects you from the neck up. If your regular attendee of this meeting would like to take a cake with us, please email our scribe, Ann P., at birthdays@pacificgroupla.org.
Hi, everybody. My name's Ann, and I'm an alcoholic.
And please email her by 6:30. Otherwise, you'll have to wait until the following week to get recognized. We have several birthdays tonight, and this week we have a special guest to sing us a birthday song.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear AAs. Happy birthday to you. Keep coming back.
And our birthdays this week are... we have Joe H. for 4 years. His sponsor is Paul J. We have Nilo P. for 4 years. His sponsor is Mitch R. We have Jennifer G. for 5 years. Her sponsor is Lisa B. We have Phil B. for 17 years. His sponsor is JJ. We have Tim N. for 34 years. His sponsor is Phil C. We have Todd L. for 38 years. His sponsor is Johnny H. We have Larry T. for 39 years. His sponsor is Johnny H. We have Sharon B. for 46 years. Her sponsor is Nancy M. We have Jim E., a former secretary for 47 years. His sponsor is Charlie C. We We have Rhonda D., also a former secretary for 50 years. Her sponsor is Nancy M. And we have a correction that Joe H.'s birthday was for 2 years, not for three. So we had 10 birthdays for a total of 284 years, the average being 28.4. Happy birthday to our recipients. We have a custom at the Pacific Group of donating $1 for each candle on our birthday cake. At the end of the year, this candle money is our contribution to AA organizations worldwide. If you wish to participate in this custom, please email our treasurer, Betty H., at treasurer@pacificgroupla.org.